Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
It's the end of December. You've had it up to here with light, fluffy, year-in-review segments across the various sports media landscape. You've done your sporting crossword of the year twice over at this stage. What you want today, I'm convinced of it, what you want today is a deep dive into a serious, meaty topic like...
Yes.
Oh, I don't know, the representation of Irish nationalism through sport amid the rise of a new type of republicanism in Irish society?
Yes. Yes.
Something like that? Is that what you're thinking?
Yes.
Owen,
I'm telling you, you know your audience better than perhaps any journalist I know. You've read the room.
I've read the room.
This is what the people want.
It's a good festive cheer today, yeah. I should say straight away, Brian Kerr is involved in this show.
Hold
in front
on a
of
second.
A live audience.
Hold on a second. Yeah. Brian Kerr is involved in this.
Yeah, so there
in
are
front
some
of
laughs.
A live audience. So yeah, come on, yeah, yeah. Come on.
If that's what you're in the mood for, there are some laughs to be had too. But it's a really good, really interesting conversation. We recorded this one at Liberty Hall. It was the same... It worked out to be the same day. We had it planned anyway, obviously. But as we were prepping for it, the news came in on that day that UEFA had fined the FAI €20,000 for the up the rat chants in the dressing room after the Women's World Cup playoff at Hampden Park. UEFA said the fine was handed down for the violation of the basic rules of decent conduct. The FAI accepted the punishment while reiterating their apology for the chants. We heard Amber Barrett speak very well on this podcast, on all this in an episode of the podcast earlier this month. But the idea of this chat you're about to hear was to use that one incident and its heated aftermath as a jumping off point to have a much broader conversation. Una Mullally wrote a piece in the Irish Times around that time that got a lot of reaction. She was placing the events at Hampden into a wider context of the rise of a new sort of republicanism among younger people. And Brian Kerr had a lot to say based on his experiences as Republic of Ireland manager and his own family background. Brian's parents were originally from Belfast before moving to Dublin. The gang's all here. End of year shows come to you with thanks to O'Hara's Irish Craft Beers.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Woo! listen, it's brilliant to have you both here. By the way, not only is Brian one of our most popular guests at these Liberty Hall shows with his brilliant football insights, he also has the ability to deliver some left field sound bites that we get to use for the next 12 months, like this one from the Gang's All Here show earlier this year.
And then I went in to get the ass that fell over the bit of tube, and anyway, I went in to get a little bit of tube. And I looks around, and there's Jerry Duff. Duffer's dad. I went in to get a little bit of tube. So it was a very interesting day. Everyone should go to the motor factors on a Friday afternoon when it's sunny.
We just don't get that from anyone else, do we?
No. Any more trips to the motor factors in the meantime, Brian?
No. I'm afraid to go in. I'm afraid to go in case I meet Duffer and he has the hump over the cup final.
Tell us, are you enjoying the World Cup so far? Any standout for you?
Well, I enjoyed Ken earlier. We were discussing it backstage. He looked like he wasn't very happy there. But also, the accommodation didn't look right where he was either. Jesus. But I'm enjoying it. When it was 10 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock, they were long days. It was hard to get away with that at home.
And if Brian Kerr is saying there's too much football on, I didn't say that.
Let's be honest. Could you put out the bins? Yeah, well, maybe about half 10 tonight, yeah. 11 o'clock. And then I noticed my car tax wasn't paid. I hadn't paid the fines for speeding. I hadn't paid the local property tax. That's a sore one with you, was it? I hadn't paid Spotify. That's another one for you. I hadn't paid, fuck all, until we got to the 3 o'clock and 7 o'clock matches. I was back in business. Half my life came back at that stage.
Una, tell us, you're a Man United fan, I believe, or have been, yeah. So you must really feel for Cristiano Ronaldo having to, you know, be dropped and watch a 21-year-old score a hat-trick in his place.
He's in an existential issue as a player in that he wants to stop time, you know, and that just can't happen.
Yeah.
I'm actually not watching the World Cup.
As in, like, official boycott?
Yeah, really? Which is really... you know, I hate not being able to watch it. Obviously, I'm doing it to myself. And the reason for that is, you know, I was in Nepal in 2014 doing this really grim story on these women who'd been rescued from slavery. The evening will get lighter, by the way. And
not that
two
much.
Live shows being covered tomorrow, by the way, both games, St. Gavin's and Liberty Hall. So.
But we were in this village in very rural, rural Nepal, near the border of India, near this town called Dangadi. And I was in this village, and I was talking to these various women. We were trying to track down this particular woman. And I kind of was like looking around and going, where are all the young men? And this fixer that I had with me, I asked him that question, and he asked someone, and he said, oh, they're all in Qatar. And I was like, what? And then it clicked with me. So this was late 2014. And then kind of since then, tracking what's been happening, I just felt, you know, I just can't, I just can't, it doesn't matter if an individual doesn't watch it. But for myself, after talking to other people, I was like, you know, this is going to happen anyway, but fuck that.
And you're not getting jealous now?
I
started out like that.
Yeah.
Because I was around a few of the places nearby, and I did feel, you know, I felt strongly that it wasn't the right place for it. But then once the matches started, people saying, are you watching a bit? And I said, just the odd bit, 10 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 7 o'clock. But there is a bit of me watching it going, it's... like, there's a falseness about crowd reaction to stuff. And see,
I'm very obstinate. So once I say I'm not going to do something or I am going to do something, you know, I will do that to myself and suffer the consequences, the hand-wringing consequences of it, yeah.
Yeah. Funny you say about the crowd, the fakeness of it. There's something about, like, the Viking thunderclap followed by the Mexican wave, followed by this cheers for Ronaldo in the last 16 games. I just thought, none of this is, like, this is not a football
and that
atmosphere.
Was a match. It was 3-2. The score, they didn't notice the goals were going there. Yeah, they were too busy doing all the mad stuff.
Mad.
You really hate that Viking thunderclap, Murphy. You never stop banging on about that.
Bring back Iceland.
Brian, obviously the women's team are at the centre of this storm a couple of months ago, and there's a bit of a line drawn under it now from the news today. In your experience, has there been a history of this kind of singing of rebel songs and so on in the men's national team?
Well, I wasn't too close to it until we went to play the match in Iran, the playoff game for 2002 World Cup, and I went to the match on the team bus that day because the whole security issue around the team in Tehran, it was kind of tight. Like, it wasn't that you were going to get the 74 down to out of the pitch, or the 77 or the 7A for that matter. Where's also, but you know,
and you were working with the FAI at that time. Yeah?
I had some fancy title. I think I was
technical
director and new team manager. Jesus. Anyway, but I probably wasn't the most popular fella around the senior international team because we were winning an awful lot of matches at the time. And I think there was a suspicion that I had ambitions about being the senior team manager, which I didn't have. In my head, I was more than delighted to be doing the gig I was doing. But there was some of the staff around the team probably felt I had that, and they kind of might have made Mick a little bit edgy towards my present. Anyway, I went to the match. I apologised for all my sins. I said confession. I did confession, absolution, the whole thing, and got on the bus going out. And Jesus, the music. I mean, the taxi man tonight did me head in with Chris de Bourgh for a half an hour, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and I'm late. And but the bus going to the match and the stuff, but it was kind of bland enough. But I just went, fucking hell, how bad is this Wolf Town stuff? And and they probably thought it was grand, you know. But I just didn't like the tone of it. And why was I feeling that way? Well, I just thought it was crap music for a start. I didn't think it was very inspiring. I didn't think there was anything about it that, you know, Barry, you could sing along to it, an odd verse if you are used to hearing those songs.
The lads on the bus, the players must have been getting something out of it, though. That's why they were doing it.
Well, tell me that Matt Holland now loved it, or Clinton.
Well, actually, funny enough, though, I would have thought maybe the English, some of the English-born players might actually be, you know, to prove themselves.
Yeah, well, maybe you're right. I thought about it. I thought about it a bit more. I thought about it after I read your brilliant piece after the girls thing happened about the girls coming from a different era and not really getting the relevance that some people might have about it, or some people's strong feelings about it. But my feeling at the time was, we don't need this. I mean, look, I wasn't beyond giving it a bit of mad stuff in the dressing room about... I remember we played England one night here in the youth match. And we were after doing kind of well. We won a couple of European championships that year. And the next match, we're at home to England in a friendly under 19. And tickets now were nearly as scarce as they were for this gig. There was 10,000 tickets bought for talking about. We're playing England, Stephen Gerrard and the whole lot playing that. And I've given it the full whack before the match about Cromwell and about... and the poor old nuns in the monasteries. And look at the heads on you, the big red head on you. But your dad had to go to England 40 years ago. And all that stuff. And which is... I presumed we were sending home a few bob for parcels, all that sort of thing. I give her all that in the dressing room. And obviously it worked very well. We were down 3-0 at half time. Keith Andrews will tell you about it sometime. He was playing. Yeah. And at half time I says, Jesus, I better have another go. So I had another go and pulled out a few more remarks that I thought, we were beating 5-0. I said, I think I need to change something here. If we play England again, don't go that road. But But not on, you know, the singing songs thing, I just getting on the bus going, but I take it what you're saying about the players. And the players from different backgrounds may have been inspired by that. One player I got into his car in England, I was over watching matches, and he gave me a lift to the airport, and he stuck in the tape. I won't tell you who he was, but he's a centre forward, and he scored a few goals. I'll leave it at that. And I went, fucking hell, does he really listen to this stuff in the daytime when he's driving around? But for them away from home, I didn't understand that. If you're away from home and you're missing out on something and you're missing... And funny, I was away a few weeks ago, I was away and I met a fella who played for me. He actually scored a goal in one of those European finals, Alan Quinn. Got a few caps, Alan. And he was telling me about his time at Sheffield Wednesday and Sheffield United, and he threw in a little remark that he said, you know the way it was, Brian, they just always called you Paddy, give us a Paddy, and I didn't realise that he was still Paddy when he was playing in England with the players in the 90s. So maybe I was wrong, but I stopped it.
You stopped it when you came
in because that was Mick, and then I had the team, when I started, I said that tape won't be on, it'd be different, it'd be, you know, whatever it was, might have been a bit of Phil O'Warren. But it would certainly, it'd have been Irish, it'd have been relevant, and it would have, but it wouldn't have been anything that I thought was shite music for a start. But anything that I thought was a bit about, let's celebrate the violence of the campaigns or whatever, yeah, whatever way you want it, republicanism. I just didn't think, I didn't think it was right.
Yeah. So did you get like pushback from the players then?
No. I probably was even grumpier than I am now. And I don't remember. I think they would have been happy enough there was great diversity in the players. If you think about it, Stephen Reid, Clinton, their background, Kevin Caban, Gary Breen, their background. You know, Robbie Damien, a Dublin background, Shea Given from Donegal, Stephen Carr, there was a lot of diversity in that. So I don't think the music should have been one size fits all anyway. But I don't know. In the dressing room, it was never in the dressing room. They played their own stuff and some of that was shy too, but it wasn't that. But it was whatever they wanted.
So, was there a big meeting about this, or was it just a standard thing?
Yeah, it was a big meeting, me and me.
Yeah.
And I decided. And
simple
I,
as that.
I decided that I just... No, there was no big meeting.
But there's no argument that we need this for team spirit and need this to get ourselves going and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I was trying to maybe change things from whatever the inspiration and stuff was before. I mean, I know some of the biggest criticism I got was about that there was too much analysis, right? And that there was too much video analysis, which there wasn't, but there was a lot more than there had been previously. And I would I was trying to change some of the culture around the team at the time. Even the music in the stadium before the matches, there used to be an awful lot of crap on the Lansdowne Road. I actually
got involved with that.
The songs that I wanted to hear that I thought the crowd might like to hear in advance of the matches, and that the players in the warm-up might go, Jesus, that's all right, that's a bit different. Who the fuck are they? What I did then was I brought them out to play for the players out at the hotel, because they didn't know who Aslan was. Didn't know who Paul Brady was. So I said, right, I'll get them to come out to the hotel and play for them and educate the players a little bit about it. About who had a different vibe.
Yeah. Una, can I ask you, you wrote a piece that got a lot of reaction at the time about all this and about what it says, and I guess you were putting it into the context of resurgence, I guess, in Republican feeling and a different way that manifests itself among young people. Can you kind of outline, if there's one point that you were trying to convey in that, what would you say that you feel about what happened then and the reaction to what happened?
I think what happened then was, you know, rebel songs, if however you want to categorise them, are not a new thing in sport, and they're not a new thing in Irish culture. The context is different, though. And I think that's what we're seeing is a generation that has no lived memory of the Troubles, for whom peace was built, for whom it was a lot of hard work and a lot of compromising was made for people to not experience the trauma of the Troubles and for them to live in peace, are existing in a context where, you know, we are in a massive, massive, profound cultural and social change in this country, and have been for some time. And part of that is a search for an identity that leapfrogs both Catholicism and colonialism, I suppose, but also responds to those things. And so I had been thinking for so long. I started out as a music journalist, and so much of my life is spent, you know, talking to artists and participating in those scenes and that kind of stuff. So it's been quite clear to me since the recession that the culture that is emerging, both artistically and the social culture, is very, very, very different. And inevitably, when that culture is there, these things crop up and that act as catalysts for situations. And it's never things we expect. You know, inevitably, we were going to have this conversation, and society was going to have to start teasing out these things of ascendant nationalism, of ascendant Irish republicanism in our society. Nobody could have expected that it would have been the women's team in a dressing room singing a song, you know, and having the Wolf Tones next to Taylor Swift on a Spotify playlist that would have instigated that. But that it is on the playlist. And that chance does mean something different. I'm not endorsing it. I'm just trying to analyse the context within which this is occurring, you know. Because there's two things that I think are really major. The reaction to the piece that I got, which was this piece that I wrote in the Irish Times about what does it mean to say up the Ra, I was surprised that an awful lot of people were actually saying, okay, there's a point here. And a lot of older generation journalists were like, no, like that, you that is not it. This is what it means. That's all that it means. And I understand that. So I'm wondering, for how long do younger Irish people have to carry a trauma of something that they didn't exist within? I don't think it's fair to say that younger Irish people don't know their history. And what are we going to do about this feeling of intense patriotism? What are we going to do about this feeling of searching for an identity, of somewhere to hang our hat on that isn't coloured by oppression? And what are we going to do politically about this feeling? Because we know that nationalism can go wrong. But there's also nationalisms, and this is an Irish nationalism, and it's very specific to our context, and I think we need to tease that out.
What makes you think, though, that young people do know their history? Because surely if you know the history and you know what the IRA represented through the height of the Troubles and what they did and the atrocities they committed, and you're still singing in support of them, what does that say about how these young people feel?
I think it's more that singing a Wolf Tones song isn't directly linked to sectarianism. I genuinely think that it is like a Go On Ireland reflex. I don't think that that's how it's received by people who heard that previously in their lives, considering that experience that they may have had, 70s, 80s, 90s. But I don't think that a lot of people who are singing that song in that dressing room are doing it from a sectarian place. The thing is with our identity and our nationalism and our pride and all that kind of stuff is that a lot of the songs that we have to sing are coloured by that. I think that there's a lot of irritation amongst younger people in terms of how they're trying to hone and form and discover contemporary Irish identity, being told, you're not allowed to sing that song, you're not allowed to sing this song. I think there's been a failure of older generations to develop, this is going to sound real self-help or something, but to develop a framework within which they can actually process the trauma of the Troubles. That has a lot to do with the political context at the time. It has a lot to do with the social context of the time. It has a lot to do with people not necessarily having the tools to figure that out. It has to do with the failure of the state with not going into extensive truth and reconciliation processes, and it's also a failure of the state to memorialise. So if you like, if you want to learn about the trauma of the Troubles, if you want to learn about the trauma of Irish theocracy, and you're a school teacher, where do you bring your kids on a school tour? I mean, you can bring them to the Civil Rights Museum in Derry.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you go to America, you can go to the Museum of African American Culture in D.C. You can go to the Civil Rights Museum at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. You can go to the museum in Montgomery. You can go, or the Memorial in Montgomery. You can go to the museum in Birmingham. Like, how can we keep saying to people, you don't know your history, you don't know what you're talking about, and there's this absence that the state has left a vacuum within which we can actually engage with that. So, and also these new identities that are being developed, this intense pride, which is all across culture, is coming from a place of Irishness. And that doesn't mean, you know, some kind of ethno-nationalist weirdo crap. It means across immigrant communities, it means new Irish, it means black Irish, it means all of those things. People are trying to forge a new identity. And within that, because of the contours we've traced around colonialism, and because of we are, you know, a country that was colonized, inevitably loads of that stuff is going to erupt and it's going to feel very messy.
Yeah. Like, I understand that the state obviously has a role in memorializing this stuff, but I think it's also incumbent on older generations, and you saw that in their response to your piece, to actually say, well, we remember it. And that was a lot of the reaction was that they said, well, okay, as the younger people work through this, we don't have to work through our understanding of it. We lived it, and therefore this chant really makes us angry. Can you see their point?
100% see that point. 100%. But considering what happened in 98, considering what happened with the peace process and with the Good Friday Agreement, considering that the entire purpose of this amazing, incredible project that the peace process was for people to not actually experience trauma and to not relive violence, asking a new generation to sit in the pain of the past, that the frameworks were not developed around, that is a very complex thing to do for a country scarred by intergenerational trauma across loads of things. One of the things that I think people raise is like, well, you know, why are young people so irate about the trauma that the Catholic Church did in so many kind of diverse ways and not the Troubles? And that's a really interesting thing. Like, why do younger generations still are absolutely raging about Magdalen laundries and mother and baby homes? And obviously repeal fed into that as well. And again, I think it's like, I genuinely think that a lot of younger Irish people understand the context within which violence in the North existed. And it's not a defense, but there was a reason for the Troubles. That's not a defense. Like, I am an anti-violence person. Like, but, and when you look at theocracy and the oppression there, it's like, why did they do that? What was the reason? It seems like it lacks a context, where I think younger people see that there is a context. It's also impossible for people to know every single piece of history, and it's impossible to feel something you didn't go through. But I think we're on a wave now of this weird, you know, Celtic revival vibe that's going on in loads of different ways. It's informing how people feel in society. It's also about a confidence in identity that has obviously been lacking in older generations, because you cannot develop like self-leadership in a culture of oppression. You cannot have confidence. There does seem to be an end of shame as a lever that forces can pull in Irish society. And there does seem to be this thing that Irish people were always taught and everyone learned in school, you know, don't get in trouble, don't be bad, don't be bold. I feel like when you say that to kids in Ireland at the moment, they'll just stand there blinking at you. You know, there's a confidence and lack of fear that's like, actually, I'm not like hindered by that. I'm not dragged down by that. So,
Brian, what do you think, just in terms of younger people and younger generations, should they be given more leeway maybe than some people give them?
In relation to?
Well, in relation to what Una talks about there, that maybe they, you know, these things, while they're not acceptable, there's a context for them.
Well, I think one of the reasons why One of the reasons why people, as you said, if you want to go and find out what happened and why did it happen and how do you get a balanced view of it, is because there's a stalemate around the place. There's a stalemate in the north, and there's a kind of a stalemate here because there's a battle going on between the emergence of Sinn Féin and the other political parties about who says what, and what you put out there has been the truth, and why I would still feel fairly strongly against any references like saying up the raft, for instance. Why it still stings with me, and you're right, it's probably a generational thing because I was around at the time when some of my relations were forced into come down and stay in the house and living in my ma's house and so on because it was so bad. And you know, the escape from that for me, not the escape from being in the troubles, but the escape in my head in terms of you doing anything about it, went back to sport and trying to educate the players that I had that the society we were living was in was all right, but it was a society 100 miles up the road that was crazy. And I brought the teams up regularly to the north. I brought Pats up regularly to the north in the worst of the troubles and played matches deliberately against Portadown and Linfield. And I can remember players on the bus looking at it and going, what's he doing? We're bringing it along the streets that were, you know, let's say highly charged in the murals and so on. And I was trying to get across to them that they had to keep a bit of normalisation, but he also had to have this interaction with people that breaks down the barriers. It just took too long for that sort of interaction to happen, to change after the 98 agreement, whatever. But it took too long for the movement of people. It's the movement of people that changes things. I was in Pakistan earlier this year, as you do. Look, well, you started it. Nepal. Sorry, I'm all over the place. Anyway, I was in Pakistan, as you do, looking for a few players for Pats, right? And after a few days there, I ended up going, we were fairly close contact, about 300 players over a few days. And they had come from all over Pakistan to come down to be involved in these trial matches. But what I noticed over the few days was that they were all sorts of shapes and colours and cultures, I'd nearly say. There was blokes from where we were in Karachi, and they were, you know, they were, the place was called Vieira, I think it was called. And everyone used to say, have you gone there yet looking for players? Because it was a hotbed of soccer. Now, all we saw was cricket everywhere. There was 175 channels on the telly, and 174 of them had cricket on. And we're over trying to find a few soccer players. Now, going away from the point, but my point was really, it was all about the movement of people. Where had these people come from? They hadn't come from Pakistan. They weren't always in Pakistan. There was a movement of people. We're having that movement going in here now. The movement has been going on. And 25 years ago, I told the development officers in the FAI, I said, look, things are changing and there's people coming in here and we need to nurture them. I want to bring it back to sport a little bit, and apologies for that, but I said we need to nurture this and we need to make it easy for them to come in, not come into Ireland, that's not your job, but to come in to play football. It's not going to be easy, but this will be the change for us when we have strong, powerful, fast players. And that's you see that developing now. And that's the chance for our society changing attitudes, not just depending on the brilliance of Paul McGrath and attitudes to him or Curtis Fleming or Philip Linnett. That the change is coming. The change is coming, and you're right about us finding a new identity. It's very complex to find that identity. With that identity, be celebrating the violence of what was done in support of the Catholic people of Northern Ireland, not really, not my name anyway, not lots and lots and lots of people's name. Why it was done and the justification for it, I hear it. But we've been too slow to react and to find the ways as you said, of compromise. I mean, this stuff at the moment, the United Ireland, the people going, you know, United Ireland in a few years, you're joking me. We can't get a United League. You can't play an All-Ireland. We can't get an All-Ireland League. And we have it in rugby, yeah, but they're different people. They've been at it for a good while. But we, like, you know, Kieran Lucid, you talk to him, he's a great lad. We're trying to do the All-Ireland League. We're going around the clubs in the north and we're getting, yeah. But I'm still going, Jesus, it'll be still a tough gig to sell when the matches start.
Yeah.
But so we've loads and loads and loads to do. But, you know, you're right about the generational thing. And maybe I'm behind the eight ball and that. I'm still giving out to the kids and saying, you better be a good boy and you better be better. And they are looking at me like that.
I want to bring Una back in on this, but just you made a reference there to people coming down and staying with you. I don't know if everyone knows your family background, but your parents came down from Belfast, I think, just before the troubles as we know them in the late 60s.
Well, there was always troubles. Yeah. There was always troubles in the north. We just didn't hear so much about them until the 60s. And, I mean, one of the, you know, I don't know. I think I know why my dad, and just go back to the church. My dad was a boxer, right? And he worked in, he had a job as well. He worked in a place called the Athletic Stores. And another night, I'll give you an hour on that story about making the football for a match. A fellow called Joe Bambrick scored 6 goals in an international match. One night, I was reading it in a book of results, and I said it to my dad. I said, Dad, imagine a fellow scored 6 goals. And he said, I made the ball for the match. Yeah. I thought he was making it up. But a few years ago, Michael Walker rang me, the journalist, and he said, by the way, do you know where the ball is? I said, what do you mean the ball? He said, the ball you damn made for the match. He did. But it's in the museum in Manchester. Yeah. But he came to get more fights. There was a priest invited him down, Father McLaughlin. He could get more fights in Dublin. Maybe that was, it's hard to believe, but he got more fights in Dublin. And me ma followed soon after, but he never wanted to go back. He went back twice for the Ulster Championships and once for his father's funeral. And he never said we should all go back and stay there. I think he understood. I think he was pissed off by the society about the battles in the society. He was from an army background. You know, that rumour that I followed Rangers, it wasn't true. But I used to look at their results. But they were his father was a high ranking officer in the British Army, and he was all around the world as a kid. But I think he saw too much violence. He saw too much army stuff. He saw too much trampling on people's heads all around the world, too many servants, that the rich people had the servants. And even in their setup, we have photographs of the officers, whatever it was, the quarters that my granddad would have lived in, and their servants, you know, with turbans on their loaf and all that. And I go, so I think that he made his mind up. It wasn't a society for him.
Yeah. What would you say to, like, a young person in East Belfast who looks out and says the societal changes that have happened here in the last 10 years are something they can absolutely get on board with, that they're not looking at it as a binary, Catholics think one way, Protestants think another, but they do come from that Protestant background, and they see that, yes, marriage equality comes in, repeal, everything, but the message then that Up the Ras sends to that person, that young Protestant or person who was born into the Protestant tradition in East Belfast, what do you think it says to that person?
I mean, I wouldn't say anything to them, you know. Like, I don't think, like, I'm from...
Well, I think it does, though. You
know, no, I wouldn't say
sorry,
anything.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
I think it says, you know, I'm from Dublin. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've grown up in the apathetic south. My parents aren't from the north. My mum is from Galway. My dad is from Cavan. They, like, the one thing that I remember growing up is my parents hated the IRA. They hated the conflict. They hated all of the damage that was being done. I think in terms of how it must feel for somebody who maybe has an inkling who's from a Protestant background or a Unionist background or even a Loyalist background or whatever in the North who sees this stuff, I mean, it must be extraordinarily offensive and right. I mean, it's offensive to a lot of people who aren't from those backgrounds, people who are in the South as well. So, like, you know, it's such a massive topic in terms of Irish unity and the prospect for creating a new state. I think the questions about it are quite small. I think we need to be very expansive. But to go back to that thing around nationalism and like I, in terms of, you know, the women sing the song or whatever, like, I don't think for a second anyone thinks that they meant a sectarianism of it. That is what it means, though, you know? So it's kind of like, I use this analogy in the piece that I wrote. It's like, if you're going to say, you know, I sang Up the Ra, but I didn't actually mean to endorse the IRA, it's kind of that thin defense of like, well, I call that person gay, but like, I'm not really trying to be homophobic. It's like, well, you do kind of have to own the things that you're saying.
But I understood that at the time when I saw it, and I had to talk about it on the television the next night. And I was trying to be, Tommy Martin asked me, I was trying to be fair and trying to be reasonable about it, and there was a little bit of me as well going, Jesus, what a fucking mistake that was, you know. But I also went, but hold on here, they were in the dressing room, and there's a fair bit of madness going on in the dressing room when you've achieved something that was a bit of a dream, and there's other songs and so on. And I said they probably got carried along in it when it started without meaning anything very... that the words that I would associate it with being offensive. I didn't even know it was part of a different song at the time.
Yeah, but
that
the, was also,
I didn't understand that.
But the other thing is that it never, the conversation would never shifted if the Sky News interview hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of people looked at it and went like, and then when the Sky News interview happened, a lot of people just went, you can't fucking tell us what to, you know.
It emboldened like, people. I got some people saying, well, there's nothing fucking wrong with the song.
But like that feeling, yeah, but that feeling is something that we need to interrogate. And like that feeling, like, there is anti-Englishness and anti-Britishness in Irish society. We need to talk about that. Like, people have xenophobic reflexes towards England. We need to talk about that. A lot of people think that the IRA was right in a blithe, generalized, ignorant way. They think what they did was justified. People think that. Like, we need to talk about that. Like, 7-year-olds think that and 19-year-olds think that. Like, these are really
common. Do they?
Like, I think that
the... No, do they?
I think that people do. Like, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and be pure about it or do. Like, I think we need to be real about the complexities of the feelings that people have in Irish society, even if they are ugly, even if they are unpleasant, and even if they are offensive. Because we're not going to get anywhere unless we're actually honest about how we're feeling about things. I'm not endorsing any of those things. And I think that I get a lot of like abuse or whatever from people who think that my analysis is an endorsement. It's not an endorsement. I'm just interested in the context of Irish society, how it is changing and what this refraction is. Because I think when you're trying to carve out a new identity in this period of social revolution, which we're in, you are going to start pulling at the strands of the things that already exist. That's inevitable. And some of those things will be remixed and reimagined. And some of those things will be like, why are you going back to that? Mm. You know, it's like I was watching The Rocky Road to Dublin the other week, you know, the Peter Lennon documentary.
Yeah.
Which is so amazing. It's on Mubi at the moment. And there's this line in it that just says, you know, what do you do when you get your revolution? You know, what do you do with it? We're having a social revolution right now. What are we going to do with it? Where are our new songs? Where is our new identity? Where is our pride that is actually expansive?
And can there be one without mentioning the feckin' IRA anymore?
Yeah, but also, like, you know, Irish nationalism, like, there's a generalization of nationalisms that said, like, you know, nationalism is regressive, it can be fascistic, it can be oppressive, it can be all of these things, but everybody knows that every country's nationalism is different. Irish nationalism is not coming from a context of trying to conjure a previous position of dominance that is insular that is trying to get that memory back. It's not like a Brexit reflex, which is why I find it so irritating with people talking about Irish unity and they refer to Brexit, because it's not obviously they're two completely different things. So that's not where Irish nationalism is coming from. That's where loads of other nationalisms are coming from. I'm still very, like, I don't like nationalisms or things, you know, in general, or these kind of fixed ideologies or whatever. But is there an opportunity to actually progress beyond where we have come from, you know, for the last 100 years or whatever, and create an expansive, optimistic, non-nihilistic, inclusive, hopeful,
non-sectarian
whatever inclusive, that looks like.
Inclusive.
Absolutely.
Of all the new people, because, as well as the older people.
Absolutely.
And as well as the people from north and south,
because
and
also,
different religions.
You know, there, a cohort that is rarely asked about this are new Irish people and immigrants, because there are more immigrants in the island of Ireland than there are unionists. And I'm not saying that it's a competition or a hierarchy or whatever, but I really feel that we need to start discussing what does a new country actually look like, because if we keep and how can we form it, and what parts of our identity are actually expansive and brilliant and beautiful, and how can we harness a pride that doesn't shove anyone out, that doesn't offend anyone, that doesn't revert to a violent reflex. And all of this is, you know, coming at the time of massive political upheaval, because culture moves politics, and the party of the day, the party that always comes to power anywhere, is always a party that responds to or somehow encapsulates, accidentally or otherwise, the culture of the moment. So it's all being filtered through a political landscape that is completely being in a moment of upheaval as well.
Brian, can I ask you just lastly, and it's been a really interesting conversation, you mentioned earlier on that you got rid of the rebel songs from the senior team. I do remember when you were having all that underage success, a lot of the images were of yourself and more particularly Noel O'Reilly on the guitar banging out tunes. And we've got a lovely photograph there, the late Noel O'Reilly. So what sort of stuff was that then, if it wasn't rebel tunes?
Well, Noel was... Noel was like Jukebox Judy on his own every night. He could sing anything, but his favourites were Christy Moore, Big Time, Bob Dylan, another. Christy Hennessy was another. He liked the Christy. Jimmy McCarty was another one. But he could go anywhere. I mean, some nights, I'm not joking you, he'd pretend he was Bob Dylan singing a U2 song. And he could do it the other way around. He'd do Bono singing. He was... see, Gary Dempsey, Joe Murphy there. That wouldn't have been too far off from teaching Andy Reid to sing Ride On. And given Andy Reid the guitar and kind of...
That got into him into some bother.
With Trap,
a couple of years
later,
as I recall. With Trap, yeah.
No, he didn't know Trap.
It's you, Brian. We've got you banging one out there.
Yeah, I think that was the only time ever I think I sang in a pub. That's actually in Malaysia. And that was the ambassador, the Irish ambassador to Malaysia, who would honour us with his presence in Sambo Morphy's pub or somewhere it was called. And I don't know, actually, the funny thing about that night, we were kind of rather pleased ourselves. We'd won the quarter final of the World Cup, and we're in the pub, and we got lovely food, and we've been well looked after, and the players were sitting around, and we allowed them to have a drink, and there was a few games and Connect Four and so on. And I remember, it's true, Thomas Morgan said, "Can we go back soon?" And I said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Ah, yeah." He said, "The lads are tired, want to go to bed." It must have been the history of an Irish team in a pub, in the, you know, being allowed to have a few drinks. It must have been unique that they said to the manager and the coach and staff, "Can we go?" We were quite happy. Noel was in full flow, as you can see. I was looking. So anyway, Noel, the range of songs, but there would definitely not have been a Wolf Tone song.
Fair enough. For various reasons, by the sound of things.
No, it wasn't something we discussed, but we were very, very conscious of the background of some of the players that, you know, Sean Bourne, who captained one of the teams that won the European Championship, London born, didn't, it wouldn't have sat well with him. Yeah. Liam George, black lad with dreadlocks. His mum was from Fairview, his dad was from St. Lucia. Again, you know, Noel would have been very subtle about those things and understanding of it was good times.
I know when we start going through the players one by one, that can be a long conversation with Brian. So listen, you've both been absolutely amazing. Really appreciate it. Una Mullally and Brian Kerr, everybody. Thank you.
There you go. Now, I did warn you, it wasn't your typical end of year fluff piece, but I hope everyone got something out of that. If you'd like to hear more conversations along these lines, then please do consider signing up to the World Service on secondcaptains.com. It doesn't cost a huge amount, and I think you'll find it value for money. I suppose you can be the judge of that if you want to sign up, because it's only... We think it's great. You can sign up for a month and then decide it's not value for money and then cancel after a month. It's that simple. All episodes are free of ads for members. And Second Captain's Murph is part of the Acast.
It's the Acast Creator Network.
Yep.
Yes, so
that's the one.
Which phone is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
The Second Captain's
World Service.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.